Hey everybody, this is Jeff. Sorry about the delay between this episode and the last one. Just a lot of life happened. We're really proud of this episode. We were so lucky to have Steph with us. She's an amazing guest. But the first half of this episode, we're talking about the election because we recorded it literally 2 days after. If you just don't care and don't want to hear some people talk about the election, and especially using pretty stale discourse, because like I said, it was 2 days after the election, feel free after you listen to the intro so you know who's who. Skip to the 32-minute mark, and that's when we start talking about what we invited Steph over to talk about in the first place. So I hope you guys enjoy the episode. Thanks for listening.
I used my favorite pen to draw outside the lines until the lines got blurry. The lines got blurry. I called my mom on the phone today. I told her not to worry. Not to worry. I held my breath in a suit and a tie because I didn't know I could fight back. I want to put the whole world in drag, but I'm starting to realize it's already like that. Am I making a fool of myself? Am I making a fool of myself? Am I making a fool of myself? I hope so. I sure hope so.
Alright, welcome to episode 3 of Sucks to Suck. It's an expert's guide to failing forward. I am Sucks to Suck's chief political correspondent, Ethan Scheibner.
And I am your head crying correspondent, Jeff Kittner. Yeah.
We have a guest with us this week.
Sorry, I'm laughing too hard. I'm Steph Best. I don't know why I'm here. Jeff brought me on.
Steph is a very good friend of mine who, originally we were asking her on to talk about procrastination and the fear of starting things, which we'll get to why that is later. But then we got a big Cheeto-colored toupee having bomb dropped on us on Tuesday. So this is probably a couple weeks after the election, so hopefully all of you have recovered by this point. Probably gonna end up talking about that too.
We'll circle back around, but, we also have James Carville and Tom Brokaw with us, but they are just tragically drunk right now, so they're not... Brokaw, get out of the fridge!
Hey, are these pepperonis?
Brokaw!
Everybody? I'm just gonna get into the cheese, it's cool.
Carville's just looking for gumbo. He's just rooting around for any of my Cajun seasonings.
The toilet's broken.
That is the worst James Carville of all time.
I have no idea what he sounds like.
He's very Cajun. He looks like one of the aliens from Close Encounters. And he's very Cajun, and he's spectacular.
Y'all's toilet's broken, Shug.
No, nothing.
Nope, hard pass.
Hard pass. Set it back. Right. We'll edit that out.
Yeah, well, like I said, this is an expert's guide to failing forward. We're a comedy podcast about failure and learning from it. And I think we've got a little bit of good topical material that we can delve into this week. Unlike the past couple weeks, I don't think we're going to start with a quiz because I don't have the effort for that after the events of this week.
I really don't.
No, but we're gonna see what we can come up with. We're going to try to get through this together, and it's going to be great. It's going
to
be great.
We're, like, going to try to be equal parts comedy and, like, self-help. We've been kind of heavier on the comedy the past couple weeks. And
I know some people that would disagree.
Yeah. Two of them are in this room.
Several of them are directly related to me. What do you got for us, Jeff? Any hot takes that we can start with?
Well, we ended last week talking a lot about, like, the importance of self-care on the internet and, like, curating your news feeds to maintain that balance of, like, seeing things or not replying to things that are just going to piss you off and making sure you still get information outside of your, like, sphere of influence and that kind of thing. I think that's a really big thing about right now because right now people are still protesting Donald Trump being elected a lot. And as many people are protesting, there's people saying to just, like, suck it up, basically, which is dumb. Mm-hmm. Because I think no matter how this played out, there was going to be protests. Mm-hmm. It's just, instead of having a picture of Hillary Clinton behind bars, it's pictures of Donald Trump making his butthole face. Like, it was bound to happen no matter what.
Because that's the American way.
Yeah. Also, we've just been, like, so inundated with this election bullcrap for so long. Mm-hmm. Like, we were guaranteed to have a hangover from it.
Yeah.
Like, there was no getting out of the scut for
it. And there's part of me that wants to feel like there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Because we've been binging on the Smirnoffs of this election for a year and a half now.
We've been getting iced for months by CNN, Fox News, NBC.
I'd like to say I'm so Mike's hard about this right now.
Taking a Mike's hard line stance on this.
And it's you're gonna feel the sickness of how sugary it is, and for a little while after it, you're gonna want to throw up.
Yeah.
And apparently there's people voicing their political vomit in the middle of the streets in every major city of this beautiful country.
Which is just, well, rude. I don't think you should be putting your vomit in the street. I was going somewhere with that, and then I was like, no, I do think people should be in the streets, just not vomiting in them.
No, okay, well.
So that metaphor didn't work out. Apologize for that.
Please feel free to express your political beliefs in the streets. Please do not feel free to express your bowels in the middle of the streets.
Or your pet's anal glands. Don't express anything, if at all possible.
There's just somebody in a dump Trump face mask and just secreting a dog's renal gland in front of the Trump Tower. It's a metaphor. For what? I don't know. This is disgusting. It is.
Art.
Just screaming art while expressing a dog's renal gland. Brought to you by Yoko Ono. But the biggest failure of this election, I think, is white people.
White people?
White people.
What have we ever gotten wrong?
What have we never not gotten wrong?
Agree, disagree.
We've invented some cool things. Mm-hmm. I can't think of them now, but I'm sure some of them are good people. So after everything Donald Trump said about, sexually assaulting women and all of that stuff came up from his past, 53% of white women still voted for him. Mm-hmm. And there's, a lot of people on Twitter saying, well, looks like a lot of white people put their whiteness before, their race before their gender.
Yeah.
Which, that's definitely one way to look at it, and that's probably a very accurate way to look at it. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know, I say white people is the big failure, but, there's never one thing that, leads to something. It's always, a snowball effect.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you say white people, but you were specifically talking about white women, so...
I mean, there's no!
No, but yes!
There was something 63% of white males as the demographic of Trump voters?
Yeah, and, that's less surprising, because of all the people who've, a bunch of privilege that they want to protect... People like you and me, Ethan, are, the biggest one. And I'm not, specifically blaming white women.
No, I don't think you are.
That's the more, surprising turn of events.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but is it, though? Because we live in a system where women are socialized to identify and empathize with men before they're socialized to empathize with other women. Mm-hmm. Especially when those other women don't perform femininity to a certain standard.
Yeah.
And what's the beef that Hillary's been getting for years is that she's not emotional enough, or alternately, she's too emotional.
Ice queen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one or the other with her.
Well, and I wonder, because I watched her concession speech, and you saw in her face, she clearly was heartbroken.
Mm-hmm.
And I could feel for her in that moment. And my mom and I talked about it, and my mom definitely did not support Hillary for her own reasons. And we talked about the fact, that's the Hillary that a lot of people, especially women, would have liked to see throughout the campaign. And I wonder to what extent it's sort of a byproduct of, she's spent her entire life in politics, and that's really tough. If you think it's tough being a woman in politics now, try being a woman in politics in, the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And how much of that is maybe just an artifact of, her developing the skills that she needed in order to make it through earlier in her career, and that just became a habit, and so now she's emotionless, and everyone thinks that she's a stone ice queen demon.
Mm-hmm. And I want to walk back something I said earlier, where I was talking about women voting for the race before their gender. Obviously, if you're a woman, that doesn't mean you have to vote for Hillary Clinton or anything like that. But, voting for Trump is pretty egregious, I would say.
Yeah, it's something that I can appreciate but never understand.
Yeah.
It's a very privilege-based thing that I can only go so far in my understanding of this because I'm unable to effectively experience it. But if there were some equivalent of a person running for presidential office that is bragging about sexually assaulting anyone, it's difficult to understand that that exists and then weigh that against other options.
Yeah.
I understand that's how an effective decision is made sometimes, is understanding the variables of things and weighing options, but a campaign that was run on such emotional pleas and fear and wanting your country back, when something as hard-hitting and emotional sensational as that comes out about the past, like a sexual assault, you don't take that to heart. It's difficult to understand, at least from my perspective.
And even just the rhetoric of wanting your country back. Like, you still live here, you just share it with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, like, terrifying to, like, all these people. Well, not everyone has lived in their country their whole lives, but a lot of these people you're talking about have also lived in this country as long, if not longer, than you.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you still feel like you have some kind of particular ownership over it.
Mm-hmm.
Is super weird. And also, like, even on the Hillary side of things, like, I don't know if you guys saw this, but there, people were posting a bunch of pictures of putting, like, I voted stickers on Susan B. Anthony's grave.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, no one was... Well, there was, like, a few people who were putting stickers on, like, Ida B. Wells' grave.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, Susan B. Anthony said some really racist stuff. I think it was her, or at least other suffragettes, saying things like, I can't believe people would try to give a black man a vote before a white woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's who, buddy?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, Ida B. Wells being told to, like, march in the back of the suffragette parade, or, mm-hmm. like, not show up at all, or have her own thing.
Yeah. That's why there's so much difficulty in the decision. Excuse me. The decision for a lot of people in this election. There's so many layers of isms and movements and everything that people are trying to reconcile. They dig deep and find their emotional centers and vote with their emotional centers.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's sexism of the suffragette movement. And then there's the racism inside the sexism of the suffragette movement.
Wait, you just said that twice.
Yes, I did. So, I don't know where I was going with this at this point.
There's layers upon layers.
There's layers upon layers. This is an onion, an orange onion of an election.
And, well, I mean, and I think part of the issue sometimes is people get caught up on the value of ideological purity.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, if you are claiming that your movement is ideologically pure, it's very easy for the other side to come along and be like, oh, well, Susan B. Anthony said some racist stuff.
Yeah.
So, therefore, your point is moot. And it's like, no, we can still appreciate the work that previous leaders have done and things that they've said, while also taking them to task
mm-hmm.
for this other stuff that they said that was super inappropriate mm-hmm. or problematic or, like, racist. It's not too, like... excuse or forgive politicians who express things that we can look at now and be like, that's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
But we definitely need to be critical and also and like come to terms with that in the history of our own side. And I'm using air quotes because I don't know, that's not the best
side
part.
Is like even
right
now when we're super deeply divided, side is a weird thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking of Treebeard right now.
Yeah, it's important to understand the image of these two candidates as whole persons and not candidates for political office. And I don't know if that maybe was a lot of what was involved in people's decision making.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's a double-edged sword because you can... This is the character of a person I want running my country versus this is the decision-making qualities of a person I want running my country.
Yeah.
There was so much vocality of both sides of both of those people in this that a lot of people didn't know what to hold on to.
Yeah, and there was a super low voting turnout. Trump won with less votes than Romney got when he lost to Obama.
Yeah.
That is how low voter turnout was.
49% of eligible voters, I believe.
Yeah. And also, like, we talk a lot about, like, taking the whole person into account, and, like, it might sound that we're willing to be more forgiving of Hillary than we are of Trump, because she also said some really messed up stuff in the past. Like, the super predators thing.
Yep.
But I think at least people who were in her camp saw that there are certain actions that she had taken since then, and stances that she has now, and qualifications she has, that kind of either made up for it or, like, balanced it out or something like that, because...
I still can't get over her condemnation of Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, exactly. That was actually a thing where I was like, I forgot that she did that.
Yeah.
Like, I'm kind of bad now.
I think it was an Easter egg in either 3 or 4 where the Statue of Liberty's face is Hillary Clinton's face.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Nice.
Yeah.
Hot coffee.
Hot coffee.
Just for you, Grand Theft Auto nerds. So yeah, I think, do you want to do like a round the table, one big failure and something you can learn from it, or just kind
from the election?
Yeah.
Oh god.
Or at least like just...
Okay, as a softball, I want you to take all of this election, identify one issue that you may have perceived as a failure, and go with it.
Yeah, I don't know. What have we learned today?
This is actually really... So I've spent, for anyone who's listening who doesn't know me, I've studied communication for 10 years now. I'm getting my PhD in this. I study strategic communication. And for me, the big thing to take away from this is, like, I don't agree with most things Donald Trump has ever said, ever, but I do have to respect his campaign because they accomplished their goal.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And he said what he perceived was necessary in order to accomplish that goal. And I know a number of people who study political science and political communication who are kind of looking at this right now and are basically asking, like, is polling as an industry dead?
Yeah.
Like, just the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's causing a lot of people to take a minute and, like, think about what do we really know about voters and what they want to hear from their candidates. And I think there's going to be a lot of very pragmatically minded experts and people working in political communication and working on campaigns who are going to take away from this that, like, maybe we need to be rethinking our strategy sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's going to be interesting just to see from a research perspective in the next few years how people study this and what sort of conclusions they draw. So I'm actually kind of invigorated. I think it's going to be interesting. And, you know, some of the stuff I've been reading is, like, his campaign, usually it's the candidate that has the most money that wins. And that did not happen this time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of promising, because he broke the system as we know it, which means it can be broken, which means we can put it back together. Like, if Donald Trump can win the presidency, I don't see why I can't. Like, I said some pretty ignorant things a few years ago on Facebook, but nothing nearly
as bad. Who hasn't been on a bus with Billy Bush and said something terribly ignorant?
I don't even want people to know what I've told Billy Bush.
Billy Bush, this is my feelings about the Inuit people.
Pinky swear that this is not being recorded.
This
right
is
now.
Between you, me, and the five Access Hollywood cameras in here right now, Billy.
Like,
Bush.
I'm just saying, like, I think there's a lot of opportunity here, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So let's see what we can do with that. Let's push the edges of this a little bit.
Yeah.
This isn't my what I learned, but it does make me think of. I really wanted to see. Like, once Trump was, like, guaranteed nominee, but it was still Hillary versus Bernie, I would just really wanted to see two anti-establishment people running against each other, because, A, you would get a race of who is more crazy and more willing to break things down.
Yes, my people.
Yeah, but also just, like, really, really send this message to lawmakers that, like, hey, everybody wants things to change. Because essentially it came down to, like, a semi-incumbent versus, like, a newcomer. Mm-hmm. And if it was two kind of newcomers, so it wouldn't be like, okay, our reaction to this is to be more moderate and to, like, believe in the system more. It's like, no, actually, literally everyone doesn't believe in the system anymore, so, like, you guys really need to make some changes. Mm-hmm. Not, you need to double down on it. But the thing I learned, I guess. It's like a theory I've been working on for a while, that there's no such thing as one reason for something coming about. There's, like, risk factors for something happening. Trump still got, what, like, 33% of the Latino vote? Which, like, it just means that you can say things against a group of people or, like, where they come from or anything like that. And obviously not all Latinos come from Mexico, but a lot of Latinos understand that a lot of white people think that they all come from Mexico, unless you're in Florida and then they come from Cuba. But it is a condition that would cause you to not vote for that person. And also, when a failure happens, it very rarely ever happens for one reason. There's multiple things that come together, like voting suppression was a thing that happened, and a bunch of people not voting was a factor in it, and then a bunch of white people voting for him is, like, contributing causes to what happened. And a lot of people are running around right now trying to figure out who to blame, and finding out the factors to it, I think, is more important, and then working against those, rather than just being like, okay, now time to work on this one thing while everything else is literally on fire.
Yeah.
So, I guess the lesson to take from that is figuring out the factors is more important than treating your perceived cause of any failure that you have.
That's fair. Yeah. Of the laundry list of dumpster fires, I would suppose that my biggest failure that I could recognize was the voter turnout. It's toss up between voter turnout and the electoral college system and popular vote system, but I'm going to go with voter turnout. Something below 50% of eligible voters voted in this presidential election, and there have to be, I can't accept that it's just apathy at this point, why people aren't registering to vote and actively voting. There has to be something, but I want to know what that something is. Stephanie's chomping at the bit here. I'm gonna pass this baton.
But pass the talking stick.
I'm going to pass the adorned talking stick.
Thank you. I appreciate this talking stick. So the Voting Rights Act. If there's anything, okay. So like, I know I made my point already, but I'm gonna make another one.
Get out!
Three at this point. I ended up doing a lot of reading in the past, like, 48 hours about the Voting Rights Act. Mm-hmm. And on Wednesday, I taught a class in the afternoon, and, like, we all just took an hour to talk about our feelings.
On Wednesday, I think I went to McDonald's twice.
Which is how you work through your feelings. We all have different coping mechanisms.
It's all okay. But I taught you in my class of, like, 22 juniors and seniors in college talked about how we got to this point, and some people were expressing frustration with, like, if Hillary won the popular vote, then why did this not work? Mm-hmm. And so that's electoral college stuff, but also, like, you know, it's not just about that, it's also about, and I said, has anyone heard of the Voting Rights Act? And I had a room full of college students, and not a single one of them had any idea what I was talking about. And this was only 3 years ago that the Supreme Court partially repealed the Voting Rights mm-hmm. Act. And so it is very concerning to me that, one, it disappeared from common consciousness that quickly, and two, I don't think we can say that this election happened without at least some effect of that,
mm-hmm.
some of the fallout from that. You know, there have been reports of voter intimidation, there have been reports of violations of voter ID laws, there have been reports of people being turned away at the polls. So I think that's absolutely part of it, to address mm-hmm. your question of, like, how did this happen? I think that's at least part of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just like Jeff is saying, like, there's a lot of reasons that things fail,
mm-hmm.
but I think that's one that we need to, like, think about.
Is it an issue of voter knowledge and civic ability? I saw, if you were on Twitter anywhere on election day, every other tweet was, if you are in line when the polls are closing, they have to let you vote.
Yeah.
Is it an issue that some people may not know the extent of their voting rights?
I think in some cases it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also a matter of, like, some of the ways in which states responded after the partial repeal of the Voting Rights Act
mm-hmm.
isn't stuff that voters can necessarily do anything about, like fewer polling stations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and everyone talked about, like, long lines on election day, and some people were like, oh, that's great, look at all the people turning out.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's indicative of a system that is not working, because
at
people have to
efficiency,
wait
yeah.
hours to vote. Mm-hmm. Like, that shouldn't have to happen. You know, I've read some things about, like, we are apparently one of few, if not the only country in the world that requires people to register to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are countries where you're automatically registered to vote just by, like, existing.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of like Ethan and I had to sign up for Selective Service as soon as we turned 18.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I was not allowed to.
Yeah.
They wouldn't let me. Bother me.
Outside of the state house shaking her fist.
Select me, you SOBs!
Just pissed me off a little yeah. bit. Yeah.
And reasonably so.
Yeah. I don't know if you would want to pull this in with voter apathy, but mm-hmm. I think something I would call voter frustration,
mm-hmm.
I think would also yeah. be a large part of it. Because like I said, I think a lot of people voted for Trump because they didn't believe in the system, and a lot of people voted for Bernie because they didn't believe in the system. And when you got such a virulent, when you have such a caustic...
there you go.
When you have such a caustic election happening... Not causes people to consciously double down, but they just, like, become so defeated in the idea. It's like, this is what I have, and this is what they're saying about each other. Like, I don't even want to have anything to do with this. And you'll be really hard-pressed to get somebody to admit that, because you have to register to vote and consciously do all this stuff. There's so much of a shame culture built up around it that people aren't necessarily going to be talking about why they didn't vote, because they don't want to admit to their friends and family that they didn't vote.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that probably also had a lot to do with a particularly low turnout in this election. And also, like, Obama just really motivated people to vote in a huge way. Like, he was getting record numbers of people to vote, like, just period. And even though he was trying to get people to vote for Hillary and stuff like that, being like, don't boo, vote, still, like, wasn't enough. And I mean that both in that wasn't enough to get her elected and wasn't enough to get people to vote.
Yeah.
I don't know, I feel like even if you hated Obama and he's yelling, don't boo, vote, even if your motivation is coming from a place of, like, screw that guy, I don't want him to get his way, I'll vote and I'll show him. Like, that's still motivating voters.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't know.
Yeah. And I'll give another example of this where I feel that it's maybe just a lack of information on the process. Is I have a friend, I'm not going to name names, but she did not vote. has not registered to vote because she's afraid of being selected for jury duty. Apparently, she doesn't think she's on the grid enough that jury duty selection hinges upon registering to vote.
Also, jury duty is, like, a very lightweight thing. I've had friends who have been selected for jury duty before, and they've not been able to do anything because they didn't meet any of the criteria to be a juror, or mm-hmm. be an impartial juror in certain things. So they just ended up having to not do it.
Yeah.
So if that's the reason that you're afraid, even if you end up being a juror, it is very lightweight. Like, they pay you to be there. You just have to sit there and pay attention for a while. It's not going to be a huge thing. Mm-hmm. Unless you, like, somehow get put in the OJ trial-esque
and
type
it's
thing.
Months.
I'm not registered to vote because I'm afraid that I'm going to drift through a time paradox. And I'm going to be sent back to the OJ trial. And I don't think I can handle that anxiety.
Honestly, if that was a possibility, I would
volunteer. I want to be there.
I will be first in the
I will be able to executive produce an FX miniseries. I will be able to meet Cuba Gooding Jr. and David Schwimmer. Ross, I will be able to meet them and vote. And, like, come on.
Where they interview all of the jurors.
Absolutely.
Like, when's Cuba coming into the interview? No, it's just you and me. Wait, so who's going to be playing me? Juror number 4?
Sir, have you seen Snow Dogs?
Juror number 4, that's an Indian woman. That is nothing like me. I'm going to be calling for a ban on this movie.
That's how I feel about voter knowledge. There's so much to learn from this that I think it's healthy to take a step back and feel for a while even. Yeah. But there's an inherent falsehood in giving up if you voted on a platform of principles. So I think that's what we're seeing in a disorganized way right now in protests, and protests that have turned violent, in air quotes. I don't doubt that there has been some destruction of property and some violence because the human persons involved in it. But I think that what we're seeing now is a result of the disorganization of the emotional haymaker that a lot of Americans have just taken to the face.
Yeah, and I don't know if, like, you voted for Trump or something and you're listening to this, like, I don't want you to feel attacked by this. This is really just three people kind of processing the loss of the person they voted for. So, like, don't think that we're coming for you and calling you racist and stuff like that.
I'm just happy you voted.
If you voted.
If you voted and you voted for someone based on a decision-making process that you have personally evaluated.
Right.
Because that means you've done something very American.
Yeah, like, if you actually researched, even, like, the local candidates and stuff. Like, we were making fun of it last week, but if you did that, good on you.
If your homeboy has a black belt, that means that's why you voted. Props.
You have questionable decision-making skills, but you have them. He's got a black belt. He has got my vote. That dude was a newspaper boy and a line cook. Yes, he's been working since birth.
My people!
My people! Black belts and hardworking Americans.
Have you ever just been in the dojo and punched through a board and just, I need someone like me at the highest level of government?
I think when we're talking about things like voter turnout and voter apathy and the Voting Rights Act and the Electoral College especially, I think we should be concerned about those issues not because Donald Trump is now our president-elect. We should be concerned about those issues because a lot of people are not confident that this is actually the will of the people.
Yes.
And is like, and I was doing reading this morning on this, because that's what I do on Saturdays, is get up and start reading research articles, and found some...
Get out of here, nerd!
Nerd!
I haven't even put my pants off yet, but I'm already reading the Washington Post.
Over my croissant.
I think I have the YouTube app open before all of my eyes are open.
You're not even, like, conscious.
Your eyes don't open, you just slam your fist down on the snooze button on the alarm, grab your phone, open up YouTube.
But what were you reading about?
Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's cool. Just like, so this happened before. This happened 16 years ago, where a candidate won the popular vote and didn't win the electoral vote.
Mm-hmm.
And that is apparently...
Richard Nixon, yep.
Exactly, yes.
16 years ago, Richard Nixon.
This has happened...
I'm a college graduate, Jeff. Come on.
Even before that, because the article I was reading was from, like, 2002, even before that, this had happened, like, 4 or 5 times before in American history. A lot of them in the 19th century, oddly enough. John Adams versus Thomas Jefferson was, like, a big thing. And it gets into discussion of, like, is this really representing the will of the people? Or is this weird, crazy system that we have that nobody else really has. Yeah. Is this why? And why was this put into place? And does this still reflect the concerns of Americans and how they want their government to run? So I think that's the things we need to be concerned about going forward. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, exactly. And pretty much everybody recognizes on whatever side that you're on, like, there's a lot of stuff that needs changed. And there's certain people who are very excited that the change they think needs to happen is going to happen. Shrug emoji, who knows? Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of people who are concerned about the fact that, like, pretty much every branch of government right now is red.
Yeah.
Is pretty concerning to a lot of people. And that's another thing I wanted to talk about. I've seen a lot of people saying, like, you need to, like, stop worrying. Like, there's no guarantee that all this stuff is going to be happening. Which, fair.
There's no guarantee that it won't.
Yeah, exactly. Like, this person has been running a platform on wanting to take certain actions and revoke certain rights that a lot of people have been depending on. And also just, like, lets them live their lives in peace. Like, I'm a queer person, and, like, I'm a white queer dude, so, like, as far as stuff that affects me, a lot of stuff that Donald Trump has said really concerns me about my friends and family and people that are around me, but Mike Pence scares the ever-living shit out of me, because he took funds that were supposed to go to helping out HIV-positive people, and he used it to fund conversion therapy camps, which is proven to not work. And also, generally speaking, it causes more teens to commit suicide than actually, air quotes, convert to being straight. And, like, has done electroshock therapy. Like, not he has done electroshock therapy.
He's the one pressing the button.
He's just
Milgram experiments all over again.
Mm-hmm. Like, his alarm goes off every 5 minutes. Oh, time to push the button. Boop. No.
Time to electrocute a 16-year-old.
No. But, like, he has funded programs and stuff that do that. And that's terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, like, I want you guys to understand that we are afraid because of things that they are saying, and we are trying to convince ourselves that all this stuff isn't necessarily going to happen. But faith in the system is at an all-time low right now for pretty much everybody involved, so you can kind of understand how we're feeling. Hopefully, we'll get over the hangover here by the end of the year, and then we'll only be, like, actually hungover on New Year's Day.
God willing.
Mm-hmm. And ready to go come January 1st, January 20th, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. On a lighter note, I will say I've talked to both of my parents, who tend to be socially sort of, like, middle of the road, economically tend to go more conservative. They're both military veterans. They spent decades in the military. Like, that's a big part of their judgment making or their judgment process.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad and I were talking, and he was like, yeah, I think it's time for, like, a third party, which people have been saying for 20 years.
Yeah.
But he's already come up with slogans.
Yes, lay them on us.
So he wants a third party, and, like, we were talking about it, and I was like, well, maybe something that's, like, economically conservative but socially liberal.
Okay.
And he was like, yeah, that would be cool, and I've already come up with a name for it. It's the Civic Party. That's C-I-V-I-C. You spell it backwards and forwards, and it's the same thing. And here's what it stands for. Citizen. I vote, I count.
That's so awesome.
My father is George Stephanopoulos.
And I don't always agree with my dad, but I really love, this is his thinking, is like, you know what we need for this? A slogan. Like, we don't even have a platform, we're not going to figure out policy, we're not going to figure out figureheads, like, we need a slogan, so.
There's got to be somewhere to start, and
yeah.
The fact that someone is already pouring energy into it.
He's casting a line.
He's casting a line, ready to reel that motherfucker in.
Yeah, man.
That gives me so much hope.
Yeah.
That's so good, I love it.
So, Gene Best 2020.
The best candidate.
The best candidate!
Kill me. God.
So, speaking of being the best, you are... Yeah. Are you now officially the best doctor?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
Talk about failure.
Nah, it's alright. Like, you're living your best life.
I'm trying. I'm trying real hard.
So, why don't you tell us the story about the path to becoming... Okay, so yeah, walking away from election stuff.
Okay, so we are turning off the election holograms.
Still I am.
No! I put Wolf Blitzer back in his cage.
Good night, Wolf.
He likes it, though, so it's difficult sometimes.
Oh, he's dreaming. Look at his little legs kicking.
So we're going to move from
a pepperoni.
From a pepperoni.
Wolf Blitzer subsists entirely on pepperoni. He's a wolf. He's an actual wolf.
Descended from gray wolves.
Descended from his father's name is Gray.
killed by Liam Neeson. The real end to, what was that movie called?
The Gray.
Yeah, The Gray is Liam Neeson facing off against the giant wolf. And it's like, a new challenger appears. Wolf Blitzer steps out just with a giant knife.
Wolf Blitzer's an anamorph confirmed!
Yes!
I knew it. I knew it all these years.
I thought those book covers looked familiar.
Yeah.
So anyway,
Photoshop did not exist back then. That was just frame by frame of Wolf Blitzer going from a 26-year-old Wolf Blitzer into a wolf.
That raises a whole different question. Was Wolf Blitzer ever, like, less than 50 years old? I'm not sure that he ever was.
He came out of the womb with a full beard.
Like the wizards of Lord of the Rings, like, he just sprung into existence and formed and wizened.
Wizened.
Wolfie B.
So, Dr. So. Best.
What's up?
Please tell us about your journey to attain the doctorhood.
Jesus Christ. Okay, like, how far back should I go? I don't even know where to start. There's so much.
Wolf Blitzer was just a young pup back then.
Yeah, was but a young pup. Let's talk about grad school, specifically around, like, doing your dissertation and stuff.
Okay, so I'm going to do, like, a real quick primer for those of you who have not gone through grad school or don't have the dubious fortune of knowing a graduate student, what this actually means. So, you do college, you do undergrad, right? Sounds great, you get that degree, maybe you go out and you make some money. Awesome, live your best life, be happy. Some of us make the choice to, and I think, you know, we need to respect that choice, because this is, you know, the kind of culture where we want to embrace diversity.
Mm-hmm.
So respect the self-flagellating choice to go to grad school. So I finished undergrad, and I was like, this is awesome, I want to keep going. So I came to Ohio State and did my master's, and then that was 2 years. So at that point, I'm 6 years into college. And then I was like, you know what would be even more awesome? 4 more years.
Solid 10.
4 more years. 4 more years.
And then I could put doctor in front of my name. And
my obsessive compulsive disorder requires that I do everything in tens. So.
So, guess I gotta hang out. That has been a journey, and making uncomfortable noises. So, once you, like, get to the point where you're, like, ready to be a doctor, or at least you think you are, I went to my advisor and I was like, hey, I'm tired of taking classes. I think I'm ready to do my exams, which is like this whole painful period. It was like a semester's worth of reading articles and reading old books and going back to and reading research from the 50s and just having to bone up on like 60 years of research and then getting thrown a couple essay questions and having to write like research article length answers to essay questions. And then at the end of all that, going into a room with my committee of, like, 4 people for 2 hours and defending all the work that I'd done over, like, 3 or 4 months.
The wizard's court, the wizard's roundtable. Where they cast judgment on the young apprentice.
Yeah, no,
before you can grow your beard and get your wizard staff.
It's,
Which is made primarily of Coors Light and Bud Light.
Please, Jeff, give me some respect.
All right, you're a grad student. It's made out of a Bita bottle.
Yeah, pretty much. I've heard people say that grad school is basically like the last true apprenticeship, because that's basically what it is like you are apprenticed to someone and you work under somebody and you're supervised, and then you go through this like grueling trial by, you know, the people who are supposed to be able to judge you best. And then if you're lucky, you walk out of that room and they go, yeah, okay, you can keep going. And like, so then you're approved for your dissertation, which is just like, fly, young apprentice, be free. And then you basically take some time to, like, you have to come up with a proposal. And I had to defend the proposal to my committee. And they sent it back. And they were like, fix this. And that was fun. And then you actually start to do the research. And I was lucky enough to get some funding for my research that I wanted to do for my dissertation. And then doing the research. And then trying to defend the final dissertation last spring so that I could finally be Dr. Best. And my committee came back and was like, no, you're not ready.
Mm.
And I had, like, really been banking on that. And then tried a couple more times over the summer, and each time they were like, no, no. And it was like, finally, I was like, fine, okay, we're just going to hold this off for a while. So, like, I still haven't hit that point. So no, you can't technically call me Dr. Best yet,
okay. But
I please continue to do so, because everyone's kind of gotten into habit at this point. And it was just really stressful, and I think part of it is that I spent a lot of time talking about this and thinking about this, and writing about this. A lot of it is coming into grad school. There's like a set of expectations that you are sort of introduced to. And my program is a very rigorous program. It's a very high-performing program. There are very high expectations for people that come out of this program. Mm-hmm. I have managed to fail almost every single one of those expectations.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
To the point that I'm perversely proud of it. That I'm just like, yeah, I am like the redheaded stepchild of this department. Isn't that awesome? And it's kind of become fun for me. Because I feel like I'm the story that nobody really wants to talk about. But it's been interesting, and it's taken far longer than I thought it would, and it's been really stressful, and it's been like that compounded with a bunch of life events, which there's never, as you said earlier, there's never one reason that something fails,
yeah.
And I definitely feel that. At the same time, I was realizing, like, I don't want to do this forever. I don't want to do this kind of work forever. I need to find a new career. What is that going to look like? Also getting out of a very long-term relationship that was like, I mean, in all but the legal sense, was like getting a divorce.
Yeah.
At the same, you know, and then last spring, my grandmother died. My cat died. You might not think those two things are emotionally equivalent, but for me, they were pretty close.
Well, also, when your grandma died, her, like, ashes went missing.
Yeah,
for
that's true.
Too.
Yeah, no, that was hilarious.
grandma's last joke.
She always loved to play hide and seek.
She always liked to hide human remains.
No, my grandmother was cremated, and I drove down to South Carolina to go to the memorial service, and it was an absolutely lovely service, and I'm really glad that I made that trip, and I think everyone was glad and really impressed at the turnout. She had a lot of, like, deep community connections, some that we didn't even know about, and people who were really eager to come out and, you know, send her off in an appropriate and respectful manner, mm-hmm. And it just would have been nice if she had been there.
She was always late, too.
Yeah, and it just, somehow her ashes didn't make it from the funeral home to the church where the service was held.
Cool.
And just because I know people are holding their breath, you did eventually find them, right?
Yeah, somebody eventually went and found my grandmother's ashes.
Okay, good.
Yeah, they're not, like, still wandering around somewhere.
Some say if you look up at the North Star, you can see him flying through the sky.
Or you could just be like that hitchhiking robot from last year where people put a GPS tracker in a robot and left it on the side of the freeway in a bunch of states.
Yeah.
Except hopefully a bunch of teenagers don't beat the shit out of it and leave it in like a BP parking lot.
Please help grandma get to California. It's her last wish.
Please just dump into ocean.
Just Mickey from like Jersey just like punches it and pisses on it and throws his Four Loko on it, and then it ends up on nightly news. Lester Holt has to talk about it.
Yeah, no, what most people in my family don't know is that I actually took my grandmother's ashes and put them inside one of those remote control droids from Star Wars.
Oh, the BB-8s?
Yeah,
nice.
The BB-8, and so that guy is actually going cross country right now.
Nice.
You just set up like a protocol on it, just go forward.
Go!
Until you hit the ocean. Go until you smell the ocean, Granny.
Okay, I'm going to go with hot take number one on why you don't have your doctorate yet. learning how to write script for a BB-8 novelty droid to get it to go cross-country.
Yeah, well, everybody's got to have a hobby.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to get burnt out if you just do nothing but research.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like my grandmother.
Yeah.
Oh! God. I'm sorry, Mom. I'm sorry, Dad.
That's good.
So, how many times have you ended up getting turned down for your dissertation at this point?
I have lost count at this point, Jeff.
Okay.
It's somewhere between 3 and 5.
Okay.
All right.
Depending on like, how you define it. Happened.
So, based on that, you only have 7 or 5 more before you hit 10. So.
Right, yeah, no, it's going to be great. What I keep telling people, because I was like, well, I can finish it in the fall mm-hmm. while I'm working, and that has kind of been overwhelming, because I ran out of funding, so like I can't be a grad student anymore. So I ran out of funding, so the department actually gave me a teaching job, which was very nice of them, so that's been helping a lot, but I haven't had as much time, and mm-hmm. managing time again is really difficult. I'm also coming off of, like, a major depressive episode. Like, that was just sort of embroiled in all of this. A year of, like, I should probably get out of bed. And 5 hours later being like, yeah, I should probably get out of bed.
Know that feel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's been a really long time. And so I was supposed to graduate last spring. And then it got pushed to this December, and now it's getting pushed to the spring again.
Mm-hmm.
Just confirmed my dad can cancel his travel plans.
Yeah.
So it's taking its time. And, like, there's definitely, like, the sting of feeling like I am the only person who has ever failed to this degree in this program in this particular way, and I am an embarrassment and a failure, and I've accomplished nothing. And it's also really tough when it's, like, that compounded with all this other personal life stuff that has been happening.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very easy to be like, my career is not together. Also, my personal life has fallen apart. Also, I have no money. Also, I am alone. Also, all of my friends are buying houses and getting married and having babies. So many babies.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to so many baby showers in the past few months. It's a little overwhelming.
These people need to stop having sex.
What? Jeff? Can you do something about this?
Listen, I'm going to school to teach people about having sex, and really, people are only comfortable with you talking to teenagers about contraceptives.
And they barely are.
All right, Ethel, listen to me.
No, like, actually, that's a huge thing with older
with elderly people. I know
they get STDs at a staggering rate.
I know, it's rabbits.
Yeah, partially because
what else do you have to do at Shady Palms?
Well, it's partially to do with compromised immune systems, mm-hmm. and partially to do with, like, well, I can't get pregnant, so why is protection?
That's
the thing the whole population does. That is a huge mistake.
Yeah, that's the crux of a lot of my decisions as well. I can't get pregnant, so
so I'm gonna chug this Four Loko.
So watch me chug this Four Loko and jump off the roof of this motel.
I can't get pregnant.
So I don't know, like, the whole process, just every step in the process has been really tough, and I think it builds up, and you get to a point where you can talk yourself into so much anxiety,
mm-hmm.
if you're not careful, which just compounds the problem, because every time I sit down and I'm like, alright, I am gonna focus on getting this thing done, writing up this document, presenting, like, literally, it's just at the point where I just need to polish. I need to finish writing the discussion section. I need to make some clarifications on the front end of the document. I need to spend a couple days making tables. Like, literally, that's the point we're at.
Okay.
Is I need to make tables in a spreadsheet. And, like, I struggle to...
Can't do it.
Yeah, I can't do it. And so I'm talking to a therapist, in case anyone's concerned. Talking to a therapist. We're working on this. She's real great. She validates me a lot and gives me a lot of encouragement, and it's awesome. But coming up against that anxiety of, like, the expectations that have been put upon you, and then also the expectations that you have internalized, and then when you already feel like you're a failure, like, all of these things come together, and you just come up against this insurmountable wall of, like, everything sucks, and I'm terrible, so what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm gonna go, you know, do Sudoku puzzles for 12 hours. Because that seems like a practical use of my time.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's good. So, you know, in small doses. 12 hours is maybe a bit much.
That's the reason we started this podcast in the first place. Because Ethan and I were talking about how insanely depressed we've been.
Yeah, I was crying in the bathroom stall at work one day and Jeff sent me a text message. So, literally, this is not a goof. This is not one of your classic Ethan goofs. I was crying in the bathroom stall at work and Jeff sent me a text message. So, since we've softballed our way into our first guest failure here, let's figure out, since Stephanie has wasted all of her time and money on a therapist, when clearly we are more qualified to do all of these things.
I don't need no degree to tell people to feel good about themselves.
Yeah, okay, so where are we going to start? So, have you, of your own volition, found any value in the things that have resulted from this? How do you feel about teaching?
I like teaching. Mm-hmm. It's okay. I'm, like, decent at it, mm-hmm. I think. Some days and some weeks are better than others.
Mm-hmm.
It's all right, but I don't know that it's something I want to do forever. Mm-hmm. And if I do, like, it's going to be in a very particular set of contexts.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, trying to figure out... And I think I'm definitely not alone in this respect when it comes to graduate students, because it's an increasing issue across higher education. I've read the reports, guys.
Mm-hmm.
And we can keep talking about how graduate students see the need to pivot their careers out of academia
mm-hmm.
and into industry or into government. And, you know, and we can keep saying that there aren't enough resources to help them do that, but then nobody does.
Nobody does it.
You know, we organize a workshop for a couple hours, like, once a semester or once a year, and it's like, all right, that would have been helpful 3 years ago. Because it's like, how to not screw up in grad school by planning beforehand.
Everyone into your Wayback Machines!
Exactly! I don't have one of those, I can't afford it, because I'm on a stipend. So, yeah, it's like, how do you make that pivot? And trying to figure out what that's going to be. And I think especially with graduate students, I think a lot of times what you're looking at is a population that is used to being special,
mm-hmm.
and they're used to being really smart. And they're used to being top of their class, and they're used to being told, you can do anything. You're mm-hmm. going to do so many great things. Mm-hmm. You're going to be amazing.
Yeah.
You're a person of promise. I mm-hmm. have that certificate somewhere in my files.
Yeah.
Thanks, yeah. kindergarten. Yeah. But what does that actually mean? Mm-hmm. And so when these people do finally come up against like these sort of existential crises and these challenges, like they don't know how to deal with them. Because
mm-hmm.
a lot of times, and I'm not saying this for every graduate student, I clearly can only speak from my own experience and what I've heard secondhand from other people, but I think a lot of people who go through grad school come up against that at some point of like, I've never had to figure this out from the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really difficult. And there's not always a lot of great structural support in place to help people through that.
Yeah. And I think being betrothed, I guess, to a graduate school graduate, what I've noticed is she would tell you something similar, but maybe it's an issue with no one is telling you what to do anymore.
Yeah, I think you're, that's a lot of
you've spent so much time with syllabi and with courses of study and registrar requirements that you need to fulfill. And when you're there, and then no one's like, okay, well, you're good. You're good on this stuff. I see. Let's see. You've checked these boxes. Wait, what do I do next?
Yeah.
What's the next box I need to check? What is it? And I think that's something that's not exclusive to grad students. I mean, a lot of us feel that way, but I can only imagine when, with all of this time invested into it like that, and having to build your own box that you're supposed to put a check mark in,
yeah,
there's got to be something anxiety-inducing about
that. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I went from high school straight to college, and I didn't go to grad school or anything like that. But, and I'm going back to school right now, even though I'm not technically, like, enrolled in school or anything like that. I'm just kind of getting free classes for my job. When I started going back to class, I took it so much more seriously than when I went straight to college. And I'm a huge proponent of anybody who graduates high school taking off at least 1 year and just existing in the world and learning the things that are expected of you. Because, like, you're, what, 21, 22 when you graduate college? But you're not, like, really an adult until you're, like, living in the world and doing things. And, like, people still have jobs and put themselves through school and stuff. But that whole, like, even if you live in your parents' house, but, like, paying rent and existing in the world and having things expected of you is so much. And even though, like, more is expected of you when you go to college and stuff. And this is the thing nobody really talks about when they talk about, like, governments paying for your college and stuff. If that happens, and I really, really hope it does, that there's a requirement that you take 1 to 3 years off and be doing something that you're extremely dedicated to. Whether it be the military or a certain kind of job or certain kind of volunteering, but like existing in the world mm-hmm. and then going back to college, A, to make sure that's the thing that you really want to be doing, and B, just to like make sure that you can take care of yourself and you're not going to have this like, what do I do with myself once you're done with college? Because you've already kind of had that period.
Yeah.
And then it's like, it's almost a softer fail state too, because you haven't had all of this like stuff you've been working towards. And also there will be less undecided majors, which I
right here, you're looking at one for about a year.
God, I don't know how you do that, but
I almost killed myself my senior year of college, that's how.
Yeah.
When I finally made a decision, so.
Yeah, it's just the idea like you're expected to go to college, because a college degree is required for things that only a high school degree was required for not too long ago.
Yeah.
And even if it's just postponing getting that degree so you can get those better jobs, you yourself will be so much more prepared as a person.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're absolutely right. And in retrospect, I try not to let myself get too caught up in the like spiral of guilt and regret and being like, oh, if only I'd made this choice, things could be so much better. Would they have been? Or, you know, you could have lost your legs in an accident. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because that's how the universe works, right? But I do wish that I'd taken some time between undergrad and grad school to really, like, figure out what I wanted to do, because I had a general sense of, like, I like this topic, I want to keep talking about it. That sounds nice.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have, like, a real strong drive to do research or to teach. It was just sort of like, these are the things that go along with continuing to talk about these things you want to talk about. And I wish I'd taken a year or two to be out in the world and, like, try some other stuff first.
Yeah.
Even though it was scary. And that's the thing that, for me, in the past couple of years has been a big lesson is, like, I personally, I think I tend to do better and I think I tend to thrive at my best when I run directly in the direction of things that scare me the most.
Yeah.
You know, ending a relationship, that's a scary thing to do, especially when you're living with someone and you're, like, entrenched in that relationship.
Yeah.
And I just had to be like, I don't think this is what I want. I'm going to run towards the scariest thing I can consider right now, which is committing to ending it.
Snakes on fire, yep.
Yep.
Scariest thing.
Mm-hmm. A box full of spiders.
Box full of spiders.
So just run towards it, okay? Mm. We will fill a house with spiders. I want you to run into that house.
Nope.
Pass. I'm just saying, I think you could learn from that experience.
Somebody, I know I've already told Ethan about this, but somebody was telling me that there was like a Halloween parade, and there was a kid who was just walking around inside a cardboard box that had a bunch of cobwebs on it. And he was like, I don't know what that was supposed to be. I'm like, are you kidding me? I instantly know what that was. Somebody told that kid to dress up as the scariest thing he could imagine, and that scariest thing was a box full of spiders. And I'm glad I wasn't there, because I would have set that kid on fire.
That's great.
Someone has some good parents.
What's the scariest thing you can think of, Billy? A box of spiders? Let's make this happen, because that's hilarious.
No, you will not be Spider-Man this year.
You will be a box of
I'm going to teach you about life.
Schrodinger's Spider-Man.
Oh my god.
Spider-Man is just sugarcoating the issue. You are going to be the reality of spiders.
You are be a man spider.
We're gonna be that. We're gonna remove Stan Lee. You're going to be a box of spiders, and you're gonna bring down the entire party.
What kind of spiders? Nobody knows.
Nobody knows.
That's the really terrifying part.
You know what's most horrifying of all? Uncertainty.
Uncertainty. Knowing there's spiders, uncertain of what kind of spiders. Could be daddy long legs. Could be a wolf spider. Could be both.
So what are you for Halloween? I'm existential dread.
But another thing I wanted to talk about. So you said you've had to, like, start over and, like, represent this, like, 3 to 5 times now.
Yeah. Which is not, like, getting to the point of calling the meeting, and each time they're like, no. It's more like, I send it off to them,
yeah,
and someone reads it and goes, nope, not yet. And they don't sign off on it for us to have that meeting yet.
Okay.
And a couple times it's been me and my advisor having a conversation where we're about, like, this isn't ready. And I'm like, are you sure? And she's like, this isn't ready. I'm like, damn it. Mm-hmm. Fine.
So you've had to work yourself and your project up to the point where you are submitting it 3 to 5 times.
Yeah.
Besides, I want this done. What have you been doing? And, like, what are the qualities that have been getting you to keep working on this thing and submitting it? Because I know it has to be, like, maybe at this point it's starting to reach, I just want it done. But, like, the first, second, and third times, like, there's something unique about those.
So it's weird in academia, at least the way I've been sort of inculcated into academia, because it's like, okay, you're going to do this dissertation, and that is going to form the basis for your research for the next, like, 4 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not excited about that. I don't want to do that research. So I have to divorce myself from the dissertation as a projection of, like, my path, so to speak. Not to get all, like, new agey on you.
Yeah.
But we're gonna talk about the path and the journey.
Great, just visualize it. And the research is done.
What the bleep do we know? But when I can look at it just on its own, I am excited about the results and the implications and connecting this, like, little tiny thing that I, like, figured out,
mm-hmm,
to all this other stuff and saying, like, this is super cool. My motivation is like, all right, let's actually do something with this. And academia is like, how about you just keep testing that same hypothesis 5 or 6 more times?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, no, I'm good. So, like, if I get to just talk about the results and their implications without the, like, strings attached to academic careers,
yeah,
that's exciting. And that's something that my therapist and I have been talking about, is, like, how do I not necessarily present these results, but tell the story of this project? Because, like, and if I can really distill it down to, like, that narrative, like, this is, we're getting very technical now, but, like, that's the really cool, fun part.
Yeah.
Is, like, what is the story here? And that's the part that I'm, like, when I am looking for that flame of motivation,
yeah,
it's a little tiny one. It's very small. A big wind could blow, mm-hmm, it out. But that's the part that's still cool.
Yeah.
Is, like, I found a thing. Mm-hmm. And I found a thing that nobody else found.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So, there's that. I don't know if that answered your question.
But. No, that is a huge thing. Even in just, like, you're talking about your path and figuring out what you want to be doing with this. And this is me trying to, like, justify all these things that have happened because failing forward is obviously the subtitle of this.
Yeah.
So, like, you have learned that this, like, this is more the path I want to take with what I want to do that maybe you didn't have on that first time.
Right.
So, like, maybe teaching is all right and decent for you, but when you get to present that information and you have something new to, like, plug into it, maybe the part of academia that you do like, or maybe if you do things separate from academia, there's something you can plug that into, like giving TED Talks or something like
right.
that.
Right, and I think, like, when I think about teaching, one of the things that I've been best at when it comes to teaching, and I don't mean to toot my own horn, but I'm gonna, is taking these, like, ideas and these results that academics can talk about and translating them down a few levels mm-hmm. to undergraduate students so that they can understand them and, like, why is this actually important?
Yeah.
And that, to me, is the really fun part. Yeah. And talking about, like, what are the actual implications for this and why is it important for you to have this information?
Yeah, that seems like an important thing to recognize and understand, too, because it's self-actualizing that my contributions to this lead to a direct line of someone else saying that maybe they can have a contribution to this. I know you're supposed to divorce yourself from your findings. Yeah. Everything should be able to stand on its own without me interfering into it, and this is why the academic community will accept it, because this will happen in a vacuum. It's good as law. But there's got to be a way to incorporate yourself into it and maintain all of the requirements for it to be approved for a thesis. And I think that finding that part of yourself that not only takes pride in it, but feels like it's good enough motivation to go is a big step. That's a big step for anyone in dog ownership.
There's a pup on. Okay, sorry, we got interrupted by a dog that had to pee.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was more than pee coming out of that thing. I think I saw the face of Satan.
Ventura. There's two Ace Venturas I could have made about that.
Fountain of comedy.
And urine. But to go off of what you were saying, I think that a lot of times when it comes to higher education, a lot of importance is put on research that is done and things that you have figured out, and less importance is put on the pipeline of information of communicating that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I know in the field I want to go into, which is like sexuality and gender research and that kind of stuff, ever since like Foucault came out, which was this French philosopher, sexual theorist, he thought that
it's in like the '80s.
Yeah,
I want to say. Yeah, it was Michel Foucault. So yeah, it's a dude.
Okay,
French Michel.
French Michel.
I'm pretty sure he went by he/him pronouns. So
yeah. So pretty much when he hit the scene, he wanted it to be taken more seriously. So he started using this like elevated language, and then what's her name? Not Bechdel, Bendel.
You're looking at me like I might know the answer to
you
this.
You might. Oh, what's her name? But anyway, so since Foucault came out, there's been certain people who have been purposefully making their language as obfuscative as possible and hard to understand, so they'll be taken more seriously, but it's really hindered people's ability to understand what the fuck they're saying. Mm-hmm. So the ability to pipeline that information down a couple levels, like you were saying, or, like, what you were saying is just, like, that pipeline of information is so important.
And while maintaining the integrity of the information that you're trying to get across.
Yeah.
Exactly. That is just as important as making those scientific breakthroughs. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes a lot of sense because you're a communication major and
right.
all that stuff. Like, it would make sense for you to, like, naturally want to fill that role more than just, like, an education one. And like you're saying, when the problem is that you have all these graduates who are just staying in academia, that's just, like, just a circle jerk of academia.
Yeah, and I think people underestimate the impact they can have outside of the academic system.
Yeah.
So, like, the best you can hope for is, like, maybe your paper gets cited a few times, and that means what? That, like, 10 other people in the world have read it?
Yeah.
You know, if you're lucky, you get added to the curriculum for a class that is 12 people.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if you're not one of those, like, top researchers, your best hope is all right, you're going to teach college undergrads, so maybe, you know, you'll touch the minds of one or two students a year, like, and really change their perspective, and, like, that's cool, and, like I never, ever want to underestimate the important impact that educators can have on students, because yeah. I have had a number of students come through, and just, you see them change so dramatically, just in this one course, over the course of a semester or whatever. And have them talk about, like, what this class meant to them or whatever, and that's always amazing.
Yeah.
But if your ultimate goal is trying to communicate some topic better, or trying to contribute to a more nuanced and, like, better understanding in, like, some debate or a social issue, whatever, like, that classroom is not usually going to be enough for you. I think you're just going to end up wanting more, so... Which is not me making a prescription for how various academics should guide their careers, because everyone's going to find their own way and whatever, blah, blah, blah. Ugh, gross. But,
gross, making meaning for yourself.
Terrible.
I just want to play video games all day.
But, you know, for myself, like, that's sort of where I am. It's like, teaching's great. I see a lot of benefit to it. I think I could also have impact elsewhere.
Yeah.
And I had... someone a few years ago, you know, I was sort of expressing this, like, frustration with all this stuff that I've done, and I'm about to be 29, and I'm like, ugh, I've just wasted all my time. Cue everyone over 29 laughing at me. Mm. But I had someone tell me a few years ago, you know, your 20s are when you figure out what you don't want to do.
Yeah.
And I think I've tried to keep that in mind, and I try to couch my own sense of failure in those terms. It's like, okay, so I know what I don't want to do, let's go find something I do want to do. So that's kind of how I try to deal with it.
Yeah, no, that's really rad.
One of many strategies. Mm-hmm.
I think that's super healthy. Also, you hear a lot of people, like, decrying people having short attention spans these days and not reading past the headlines and just being anti-intellectual, which are all problems, but I think it's also a problem of, like, academia and people who have this knowledge not looking for new ways to present that knowledge to engage people who aren't necessarily interested in consuming it in the ways that you have in the past. So I don't think it's people want to be willfully stupid. I think it's people just don't care about the way it's being presented. Because even people who are just like, oh, people are so anti-intellectual, then they don't read past the headline of John Oliver completely owns Big Pharma, mm-hmm. and then they watch a 5-minute video. Finding ways to engage people on that level and getting them, like, thirsty to know more is a thing that I think is going to be super important in the coming years. Because as much as you want to call, like, people who voted for Trump or people who didn't vote at all, or even people who voted for Hillary as just being willfully ignorant and stupid, I don't think anybody wants to admit to being stupid or wants to be stupid. But they want to be engaged on their level.
Yeah.
Which is where, like, what you guys have been saying about, like, being able to pipeline that information is extremely important and necessary. So how have you been taking care of yourself?
Oh, God.
Because, honestly, this is why I wanted to have you on, because I know you've been doing so much stuff.
Yeah.
Well, it also kind of fits in with our internet episode, because I know some of the stuff you've been doing. We don't have to talk about it.
Why you gotta rat me out like that, Jeff?
We can totally edit out that last sentence.
Why you gotta rat me out like that? No, that's cool. That's cool. okay, fine. We'll go there. I haven't even talked about this with my therapist, so that's how deep we are now. Ooh. That's how deep we're in, Jeff. This is fine.
Here, just so you don't feel pressured about talk about anything, I will restart. So, Steph, how have you been taking care of yourself through these months, years, etc.?
Well, Jeff... Now that you've asked that question for the first time, So you have those moments in your life that just sort of lead you to a realization of, like, oh, things need to change.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I knew that I wasn't satisfied with my life, and I knew I was discontent, but this is the thing that's actually causing me to change things. And for some people, that could be things like a near-death experience, or the death of a loved one, or the birth of a child, or I don't know what other great things that happen in people's lives, great and terrible things, you know? Yeah. I don't know, maybe the candidate you preferred didn't win in an important election. Completely hypothetical. I don't know, and you decide to change your life. For me, that moment was in the spring of 2015, when I saw a little indie film you might have heard of called Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, do tell!
Oh, yes, indeed.
I might have seen it once or thrice.
Thrice is really, that's it. But Yeah, so some people have really sublime moments of realization. Mine was a car chase. It was a car chase.
So the whole movie.
Yeah, the whole hour and whatever. But it was just, I mean, and if you haven't seen this movie, you can join me at Gateway over Thanksgiving weekend.
Yeah.
Because they are playing all four Mad Max movies. You're all invited. It's going to be awesome.
The second one and fourth one are going to be awesome.
Excuse you.
You'll see me in my Tina Turner cosplay.
Yes!
You'll be able to recognize me.
Shoulder pads.
Two men enter, one man leaves. I'll take a large popcorn, please.
You come with, like, an inflatable bouncy jump that's your own funny room.
Yes! Raggedy Man. That's going to be amazing. Yeah, who runs Bottertown?
Who runs Bottertown? How much is it?
Can I get the Bartertown bucket, please? And the Master Blaster Slurpee deal.
It's just like a giant Slurpee that comes with a small Slurpee for free.
Yes!
Can I get a cup holder and it's just like an engine block with the pistons removed that you can lower the giant cups into? Oh man, this place goes all out.
You can get
Why
a bottle
Why is there
of...
sand in my popcorn?
My immersion's broken!
Yeah, you can get a bottle of water, it's $46. Yes. And you have to order it by Aqua Cola.
No, you have to stand under a giant waterfall with a bucket to try to collect it.
You get one of those like little tiny like complimentary cups.
Yeah.
And it's a huge waterfall, and that's all you get. So it's just a massive waste.
Yeah.
And you paid a massive amount of money for this.
They confiscate your clothes and put you in like ragged potato sacks.
Cosplay is compulsory at Mad Max Wasteland Weekend.
Check you for gout before you come in.
You don't have any gout. Okay, we're just going to shave your head for you.
Silver spray paint.
Yeah, it's
good to go.
Awesome. Yeah, you can wear a bedpan on your head as a protective, like, sun shield. It's
fine. God. I'm the one guy that shows up as Buddy from Six Stream Samurai. Did I show up in the wrong wasteland?
Yeah, so I saw this movie, it was pretty great. And it just, like, it's kind of funny to joke about, like, a car chase movie changed my life. Mm-hmm. But also, like, film is art. And even, you know, film that is designed to cater to, like, pop culture interests is still art. And it really just, it struck me at a point in my life where I really needed it. And made me kind of, like, wake up and go, what's going on? What's wrong in my life? And just sort of, like, made me rethink a lot of things. And I started engaging a lot on the internet with the fandom, because, like, I saw this movie more times in theaters than I can actually count, and I know it's more than I can count on two hands, with five functioning fingers on each hand.
Not ones that have been removed because you stole something in Bartertown.
Yeah, and they are both my hands.
Yeah.
Neither of them have been chopped off yet for my Furiosa cosplay. But it just, like, it struck something in me, and I started engaging in fandom and doing a lot of, like, writing and talking about it and making fan videos, which I'm still reluctant to subject my loved ones to, but I do think they're pretty amazing. I'm pretty proud of them. And now you should see my Star Wars fan vids, because that's...
Yeah,
you
know, I've seen a couple of your Star Wars fan vids. My favorite is a joke that we made together, where it was the Rogue One trailer, but that John DiMaggio alarm that goes off halfway through, like, woo, woo. We joked, basically, Steph redid the Rogue One trailer, replacing the alarm with the saxophone solo from Careless Whisper. And to us, it is the funniest thing in the world.
Like, there's like four people who know about this joke, and none of them thinks it's as funny as we do.
Yeah.
It's great.
It's so good. We'll link in the description.
Yeah. Or my personal favorite is when I took the Pinky and the Brain soundtrack. And did it with the bad guys from Force Awakens. That's my favorite one. There was also the Backstreet Boys one, among others.
Pinky and the Ren.
Narf! That's my favorite one. Or when I took a shot from Fury Road and put La Cucaracha over it. It's the horn on the warp.
The Homer Simpson bubble ring.
It's pretty great. And this is how I entertain myself. But these were the things that brought me joy for... You know, in a dark time in my life, was locking myself over Thanksgiving break and putting, you know, Mad Max clips over Man of Constant Sorrow, which is funny to no one but me.
That's really good.
Yeah, so it's been a lot of that, and it's actually been really good, because, like, you know, you make internet friends. I think everyone does that these days, or I'm just hopelessly nerdy. But I hope everyone does, because internet friends are really great. And it, you know, it has connected me to things that I was interested in for a long time that I just sort of repressed or put on the back burner, like art and music and film, and these are things I really care about. And so my self-care, like rediscovering self-care in the past couple years, has been about connecting with my creative energies and embracing those and like not trying to discount those or brush them off as like, well, I can't get a job doing this, so it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And like, that's really toxic thinking to engage in, I think. Mm-hmm. And so trying to find those things that I do where the joy doesn't come from, is it going to make me money or are other people going to like it? It's just, I'm sitting alone in my room at 2 a.m. laughing my own ass off because I made some joke that no one else would appreciate. I am my own audience, and that's been really fun. And so engaging on that level has been really great for me, and finding those sorts of things and like understanding, like, I don't have to be like this, the standards, the expectations are completely gone. Like, I don't have to be the best at shit when I'm chopping together, you know, copies of Mad Max into little music videos. Like, nobody's expecting anything of me. Yeah. And that just allows me to have a lot of freedom and, like, this is just for me. And yeah, I'll put it on YouTube because maybe someone else will get a giggle. I don't really care if they do. It's just about me.
Yeah.
Honestly, what I appreciate the most is when people, like, the people I love, look at them and they're like, what is wrong with you? Like, you are terrible. I told one friend about him and I was like, oh yeah, I make all these Star Wars fan videos. And he just kind of gave me a look and I was like, do you want to see them? And he's like, I truly don't.
Hard pass.
I sincerely do not. And I was like, that's cool, it's fine.
Just tight grip on the signpost next to you.
It's fine.
Just remove it, and there's just an imprint of a hand.
Yeah, so finding self-care, I've also been trying to like double down on my efforts to connect with community and trying to find people like me. So maybe that's not necessarily always like academics, because I am not pursuing the same things as a lot of academics, but I do find other communities that I can invest my time and my energy into and that I find rewarding because I think they're important. So doing like LGBTQ advocacy work and working with some local organizations on that has been really meaningful to me, and is actually like, now people are tapping me to like do presentations on that stuff, and I'm like, I don't know at what point I became an expert on this, but okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool. So there are days where it's just like, I don't necessarily feel great about grad school or my dissertation or research or academia, but I am good at other things.
Yeah.
So I think it's really about like diversifying things that you are maybe kind of good at.
Yeah, and that's the description on the back of the box of what failing forward is.
Yeah.
And it's
for 2 to 4 players.
For 2 to 4 players.
Half an hour playtime.
Yeah. But it's
players
like
5 and up.
It's 2-star difficulty though. So there's these experiences and feelings that you've discovered about yourself. Is there a way that you can find that you can take the energy that you get from Benny Hill Mad Max? Which you're welcome to use that if you want.
I'll credit you on that.
And an academic dissertation, like the energies that are required for one and the energies that are required for another. Is there a way to bridge that gap?
I think there can be. So it was a few weeks ago. I was out on my balcony having a very poetic Saturday afternoon, doing some reading and writing, and I was listening to some podcasts.
Mm-hmm. Ashing your cigar on an orphan.
Yeah, it's just. And it was either This American Life or
Sucks to Suck, an expert's guide to failing forward. Your favorite podcast?
Yes, that one too.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
The whole one episode that was available before I came over here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. What was the one I was listening to? I don't know. Some science-y themed one. And they were presenting science-y stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is kind of how I do, except mine is much more dry and much less interesting. And then I was like, what if, self,
mm-hmm.
what if I tried to write my dissertation with the same level of, like, narrative and, like, emotional intrigue as these podcasts are written? Because like that, the way people will tell these stories that are very scientific, but they'll connect it back to daily experience and people's lived lives. I think that's where you see a lot of that value that Jeff was talking about earlier of like communicating these ideas. And I was like, what if I try to turn this thing on its head a little bit, or at least, like, slightly sideways, and don't just approach it as, like, this dry thing that I have to get done, but, like, this is something where, like, I have the raw materials. Now I'm going to shape this into something really artistic.
Yeah.
And that's where I actually become, and I think I would not have taken that approach if I was trying to rush to get this thing done and then it had been accepted 6 months ago. So now I have been given the time to sit with it and think about it a lot and think about how I want to present this information. And I think, crossing my fingers here, I think I can turn out something that is a lot more appealing, not just from, like, a dry research scientific perspective, but from, like, an engagement perspective on, like, the human level, which is where I think I often feel very frustrated with research, is not engaging with it on, like, that human level, because it's difficult sometimes when you're looking at statistics and, you know, confidence intervals and p-values and whatever else. Like, it's difficult to engage with it on the human level, and what does this actually mean for people living their lives? So taking artistry and trying to translate artistry into the work that is at times very unartistic feeling and turning it into an art and trying to put that same kind of passion into it. So I think that's one thing. I don't know if other people want to take that away, but that's been beneficial for me. So artistry and trying to live art instead of just do art in my spare time.
That's beautiful.
Aw, thanks, Jeff.
Like, you can even hear Louise in the other room.
Oh, Louise is the dog. Okay, I don't know if you guys have clarified that in any
way. No, Louise is the child that we have locked in a cage in the next room.
We test our jokes on her.
Yeah. Louise is sad.
That's why she's crying all the time.
Are you sad because you haven't eaten yet today, or are you sad because of what she said? A little of both.
Call me, call B.
It's never just one thing, Jeff.
You're always right, Jeff.
All right. I think that's a pretty good place to wrap up.
Yeah, that's great. We really appreciate you sharing your story.
Yeah, man.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
I had a great time. I'm gonna send the podcast to my therapist and see if we can just skip this week's session.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm sure
that'd be really helpful.
That will just get you going fine.
Yep. Yeah, no problems there.
So thank you so much for listening this week. Oh yeah, also news in our theme song, Power Bottom.
Speaking of failed, let's do this as failure of the week, Jeff.
Failure of the week.
Oh, okay. So
yeah. So our theme song is Serving Guffman by Power Bottom. You heard it when it started up, you're about to hear it when we're winding down here. This week they got their van stolen that was full of their equipment and the band they're touring with, Lisa Prank, while they were in San Francisco the day after the election. And because it was San Francisco, I don't think it, like, people are talking about all these instances of, like, racism and homophobia happening. Considering it was in San Francisco, I think it was just some dickhead that wanted to steal a van full of band equipment. So that got stolen, and then Gibson gave them a Flying V guitar, like, lent it to them to finish out their tour.
Okay, that's pretty rad.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So, like, a little, like, failure, but then, like, silver lining, like, that's really awesome thing for that to happen to them. And I told my girlfriend Katie about that this morning, and she just goes, that's good allyship. That's how you be a good ally, is you see a really queer band, and then you give them a Flying V to finish their tour. Good on you, Gibson.
That's corporate allyship. Not the most marketable thing, but the right goddamn thing to do.
Here's the raddest guitar you can play for the rest of your tour. Anything else you want to finish out on?
No, just don't steal kick-ass queer band guitars and amps and drums and shit.
Yeah. Have a good week and take care of yourselves out there, people. Love you. Am I making a fool of myself? Am I making a fool of myself? I hope so. I sure hope so.